Welcome to Radio Free Albion with Tony Trigilio. My guest today is Joe Harrington. I'll be talking with Joe about his recent book, Things Come On, which was published by Wesleyan in 2011. Welcome to Radio Free Albion. This is Tony Trigilio, and I'm talking today via Skype with Joe Harrington. Joe Harrington is the author of Things Come On, an amnioir, which was published by Wesleyan in 2011. It's a mixed genre work relating the twined narratives of the Watergate scandal and his mother's cancer. Things Come On was chosen by National Book Award winner Camille Dungy as a Rumpus Magazine Poetry Book Club selection. Harrington is also the author of the chapbooks Earth Day Suite, Beard of Bees Press, 2010, which is available as a free PDF, and Of Some Sky, which is forthcoming from Bedouin. He's also the author of the critical study Poetry and the Public, The Social Form of Modern U.S. Poetics, which came out from Wesleyan in 2002. His creative work has appeared in Hotel America, Bathhouse, 1913, A Journal of Forms, Notel Motel, Withstand, Otoliths, Facsimile, and PQ, among others. He was the 2005 Walt Whitman Chair of American Literature and Culture at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands under the auspices of the Fulbright Distinguished Chairs Program, and he is currently Professor of English at the University of Kansas in Lawrence. Hello, Joe. How are you doing?
Doing good, Tony. How about you?
I'm doing great. Thanks. Thanks for coming on the show.
Well, it's so exciting to be here.
Yeah, this is fun. And I know we everyone should know, the 10 million people who are listening should know that today and yesterday, Joe and I were trying to make sure that we had our Skype connections working. And yesterday I had so much trouble with my computer in my office, and I usually do these in my laptop at home. But around 1 o'clock this afternoon, we made it all work and we knew that our connections were going to be fine.
And now we're ready to go head to head with the Super Bowl.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. Well, I won't say anything about the Super Bowl because I'm a Boston person and the Patriots are out of it. And I know everybody hates them, but when the Red Sox are doing bad, I live vicariously through the Patriots, I guess.
Right. Well, hey, that's not a bad alternative.
It's really not. And, you know, the Red Sox have been just such a group of detestable human beings the last couple of years. So. Well, let's talk a little bit about Things Come On. You know, it's a mixed genre work. It's a book of poetry, could also be considered a book of lyric fragments or gigantic lyric essay. And, you know, and there are so many ways you could label it. But what I think is most important is that it's a book where the personal and the political are really inseparable from each other and without losing any sense of art or technique.
That's great. That's good to hear.
Yeah, you know, and it becomes, it's harrowing when it needs to be. And then as a reader, you know, I get excited by the artistic moves it's making too. So it manages to do a lot of things at once that some books can only do. They can only be political or they can only be personal,
right.
You know. I want to mention quote from the dedication to the book, and it's rare. And this may be the only time I've talked to a fellow poet and said, let's talk about your dedication. But I think it's a good sort of pathway into the book. It's dedicated to your mother, Elizabeth Peoples Harrington, and also to, quote, all others who have fought cancer, Nixon, or both. And I think that's a good description of, it gets us started anyway in thinking about what's happening in the book, like the plot of the book. But is there more you'd want a reader to know about what's going on dramatically, you know, plot-wise in the book?
Well, the reason that this braided narrative, if you will, occurred to me was simply chronology, that my mother had cancer. She was diagnosed with breast cancer not long after the Watergate break-in. And she died the day that Nixon announced he was going to resign. Mm. So those events are very much bound up together in my memory, even though I don't have a whole lot of really specific or vivid memories of that time, except that Watergate was going on at the same time. And so visiting my mom at the hospital and watching the hearings on TV have sort of all glommed together in my mind, basically.
And when you say you have very few memories, you have very few clear memories of that period, it makes a lot of sense because there's this horrible trauma for you, and it's a horrible trauma for you, and what's the mind going to do but try to repress that awful time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that may be part of it. That's definitely probably part of it. I think another part of it too, and you know, I've been asked about, well, what's the connection between the political Watergate material and the personal, you know, medical, psychological aspect. Mm-hmm. And you know, I want to let that hang fire. I don't want to tightly determine what that is. But I think if there's anything that's a grounds for that analogy, it's the notion of cover-up.
Yeah.
Because, well, for those who are maybe born before me, which is most everybody these days, you know, Watergate was all about this gross misuse of power by the president and the attempt by him and his aides to cover up certain illegal activities they had performed. And so there was this whole idea of cover-up, of what is the White House hiding, and so on. And also in terms of cancer, I mean, it's very hard to imagine for people nowadays, especially young people, who've grown up around the pink ribbons and, mm-hmm. you know, cancer awareness and all that kind of thing, to really put themselves back in the space where people did not talk about cancer at all, mm-hmm. and especially breast cancer, because it involved breasts. Mm-hmm. It really wasn't until the first lady, Betty Ford, and the second lady, mm-hmm. Quote unquote, came out as breast cancer survivors in the mid-70s, right after my mom died, basically. It was really then that the openness about cancer, and particularly breast cancer, began.
And, you know, when I was rereading the book, I was thinking about that issue of how when I was so accustomed to, when I was younger, when someone had cancer, it was just not something you talked about in polite mm-hmm. conversation.
Yeah.
And if it was breast cancer, like you said, absolutely not, because it involved breasts. And
yeah.
And when I was rereading the book, there is this sense that Betty Ford is actually coming out with it, which would seem so, it just rings so out of tune to our ears in 2013, but it's of the times that's what it would sound, that's what it would come out as.
Yeah, and times change. I mean, you know, when you look at, you know, Robert Duncan writing about being gay in the late 40s, and you go, you know something about that period. I mean, if you don't know anything about that period and you read it today, you go, oh, interesting. But, you know, if you know what was going on at the time, you go, holy, you know, Jesus, that's pretty gutsy. So, you know, I mean, these attitudes change, and it largely changes because of gutsy people like that, I think.
You know, and I was thinking too, as we're talking, I was thinking about when you talk in the book about your mother's treatment, you know, there's also a sense that I forgot just how overly aggressive the treatment
oh, yeah.
was for breast
Absolutely.
Cancer then, in ways that it's just not today.
Yeah, and those two things I think are bound up together, because one of the reasons that people can talk about cancer today is that people survive.
Yeah.
When you had breast cancer, even up until when my mom got sick, it was pretty largely fatal. And in fact, one thing that I didn't realize before I started doing research is that the use of chemotherapy for solid tumors was really in its beginning stage. Mm-hmm. They'd been using it for leukemia, especially childhood leukemia, for like 20 years. But the use for solid tumors was really not that well developed. So it was kind of the dark ages as far as the treatment modalities were concerned. But one thing that I found looking at memoirs of cancer survivors, breast cancer survivors then and now, is that even though the treatments were light years ahead of where they were, and I think that's no understatement, the psychological and emotional experience of being diagnosed, of having surgery, of going through the treatments, is there's some real similarities between now and then.
And I felt that as I was reading the book, the psychological components for both you as the young Joe in the book and your family and of course your mother, that felt contemporary to me. And it made me think of just how much research went into this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a fair amount. And I, one thing that happens in this book, I mean, it's kind of a montage or collage to a large extent, because I researched, well, I went back to the Watergate stuff thinking, well, if I look at the Senate hearings, all of the memories are going to come rushing back and everything will fit into place and I'll write a bestseller and be famous. Well, I didn't really think that, but
wouldn't it be great if Watergate could be the cause for you becoming famous? It would be like the ultimate fuck you back to Nixon, I think. Yeah. But I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, that's quite all right. Yes. Well, I said that would be okay by me. But it didn't quite pan out that way, like, you know, in the movies and all, but it did. I did notice as I was researching, I researched the transcripts of the Watergate hearings, the White House tapes. Nixon made tapes of all the conversations going on at the White House, which is really what killed him in the end, because mm-hmm. the Senate subpoenaed the tapes and the Supreme Court told the White House to fork them over. So I researched those as well as news accounts and so on. And I also, I got my mom's medical record from that last hospitalization, which was really amazing that they still had it, but they did. Mm-hmm. And I used that as well as looking at medical journal articles about breast cancer in the mid-early 70s. And I found places where the two discourses kind of resonated with one another in weird ways. And again, you know, cover up being kind of one obvious way where they intermesh. And I'd even forgotten that John Dean, who was counsel to the president, he testified that he had told the president, he wanted to emphasize how serious the matter was to Nixon, who he didn't think quite got it. And he says, I told the president that there is a cancer growing on the presidency, and if the cancer were not removed soon, that the president would be killed by it, meaning politically. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I hadn't remembered that until I started pursuing this kind of dual narrative research. And then there it was, which on the one hand made me think, well, that must have been in the back of my mind, because like, you know, most other Americans, I was watching these hearings on TV. It was like sort of the last big public event in America. And I heard that when it was broadcast for the first time. But it also made me think, well, you know, maybe I'm onto something here. I mean, there's obviously the very old metaphor of the body politic, you know, the notion that the state is like an organic physical body. And so cancer would be this kind of malicious, malignant, abnormal spin on what is supposed to happen within the state.
It's, you know, when you were talking about, it's really interesting to think about how you go into the research, you're not quite sure where this is going to go. Mm-hmm. And then like anything else, the research just sort of tells you what direction you need to go in. And for me as a reader of the book, it was sort of the same way. I also had forgotten what John Dean had said. And then when I get to that part in the book, I had to just shut it and put it down for a moment. And even as you were talking right now, when you started to mention John Dean, I started to get the smile on the face because I'm thinking, oh, he's going to get to the cancer on the presidency line. I know it. And
yeah, well,
the book coheres, you know, it's just so like both narratives just sort of collide at that moment in the book. It's really important.
Yeah.
You're talking about all the research that went into the book and how the research, and it's an extensive amount of research, and how the research sort of helped direct you, you know, direct the book on where it should go. Mm-hmm. I'm also struck by the choice you made to tell the story in fragments. I mean, the fragment is just vital to how we experience this book, I think.
Right. Yeah, I think that's right. And I mean, it's subtitled an amnoir, which is a portmanteau word of amnesia and memoir. So a contradiction in terms, because I'm writing something that in most cases would be a memoir, and yet the memories are kind of scattered, and some of them are scattered in the book. But part of the reason I did the research was to try to reconstruct what that moment was like, both for me and for the country. So I sort of saw myself as doing the kind of investigation that the Senate Select Committee and the special prosecutor were doing at the same time to try to uncover, well, what really went on. So that's kind of how I viewed it. And it is a book of fragments and a book of lists. And I think part of that, well, part of that is just the fragmented nature of the various sources and narratives I'm bringing together. The fact that I am looking for, was looking for, parallels and resonances between the different discourses. But also, I think another reason, and this is maybe the mimetic fallacy, but trying to give a sense in terms of the form of the book, that letting the form carry a lot of the emotional and ideational content that I wanted the book to convey. So that it's not just what the words are talking about, but it's the way they're arranged on the page. It's how we move from one to another to another. And there's a footnote from Kristen Prevolet, who I'm a big fan of, who wrote a memoir, essay, multi-genre book about her father's death by suicide called I Afterlife. And one of the things that she says in that book is something to the effect of, if the text has trauma or set or grief at its root, that the text might take a fragmented, torn apart form. Well, I hadn't really considered that until I read that, but in some sense it make in some respect it makes sense to me, as well as just the stuff that I read. I mean, I trained as a scholar of modernism, and I guess I'm not done with it yet.
And I feel the same as a reader because of my scholarly background in modernism and postmodernism. I feel like this is a book that puts into practice the sort of things, a person would write about as a scholar of those fields. Rather than just talk about how somebody else has done it, you're applying it to your own work and the stuff that's buzzing in your own imagination.
Yeah, try to anyway. I mean, one way I think that collage poems changed in the late 20th century and into the present is that, I mean, there is a certain impersonality about modernism. You read Pound's Cantos and you very rarely hear anyone identified as Ezra Pound speaking,
Yes.
as you might have noticed.
Especially in some of those really anti-Semitic moments.
Oh yeah, oh
Yeah.
yeah. He really doesn't want to identify himself then.
Right.
But clearly, I mean, this is all about myself, my family, also about larger issues, about representation, about the materiality of language. I mean, that's one of the reasons that I didn't write it as a traditional prose memoir. And maybe it's just from being a scholar and producer of poems, but I'm always aware of language being in the center of my life and existence, and being the thing that connects me with the world, and connects me with history, because that's what history is it's text. And so I did want to foreground that aspect of the work and make sure that I wasn't bringing the reader in and trying to produce some kind of mimetic simulacrum of what actually happened, because I don't think that we have access to that.
And that's something that I think it comes up sometimes between the lines of the fragments. And I think some of the fragments even, engage this more directly that, history is made up of these efforts we're making to tell the truth about something. And, the closer we get to telling that truth, we find out there's more language required. And then we get closer, and then it keeps receding from us. It's like the fragments are there to try to repair something that never quite gets repaired, though, but we have to keep trying.
Yes. And that's clear with the cantos, you know. It's like he can't stop.
And it's great
It's an unfinished poem.
that you mentioned Pounding Again, because I felt like I wanted to go back and redeem him a little bit. It was too easy for me to just go to
Yeah.
the
Right.
anti-Semitic pound, because I do think he's doing that too. And it's one of the things I admire in the Cantos is that he can't stop. That the language, that it's his life's work, and it's going to go on, or it went on as long as he had language. And there's integrity, art, real artistic integrity in that. And so it was too easy and cheap for me to bring up the fascist pound. When I was rereading the Cantos, 7 or 8 years ago, I felt really humbled by all those times I had attacked Pound. And I thought, this is as good as the first time I read it, and as exhausting in all the best ways.
And it's interesting too how other poets who completely reject Pound's political philosophy really have learned a lot from his technique and form. For instance, Zhukovsky, if you look at some of the early sections of A, there's no way he could have written those without reading the cantos, maybe not without being friends with Pound, and yet they're very leftist, basically.
Well, the objectivists themselves, exactly. This group of left-leaning poets, most of them Jewish, and Pound is one of their sibling influences. I know it says something about how technique can be paramount and how important it can be. Well, let's hear a poem, or if you want to read an excerpt from the book, or if there's something else you'd like to read.
Okay, I'll just read an excerpt from Things Come On that hopefully will touch on a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about. And I should say some of it is in verse, some of it is in prose, some of it is quotation, some of it is original wording. So I'm not going to say quote unquote for the quotes. I'm just going to try to convey it with the voice.
Okay.
A memoir is a mirror with a memory, but if memory becomes corrupted and crashes, then order flails to reflect things just as they were. June 17, 1972, Watergate burglars arrested. October 10, 1972, Washington Post reports that FBI has diagnosed pattern of systemic metastatic sabotage conducted by White House biopsy operatives. November 7, 1972, Nixon reelected in landslide. Non-normative nuclear families, cancerous, shamefaced, built on sand slide. Mother made family, the beast, the breast, diseased, covers it up. Nuclear family therapy, scandal. Question. So you would have been 10 when your mother was diagnosed? What did you know, and when did you know it? Whisked away under cover of darkness and forced to submit to an ordeal cloaked in secrecy. Mugging squads, kidnapping teams, prostitutes, electronic surveillance, intercepted aircraft communications, espionage, shredding. I did know absolutely nothing. Some New Testament exegetes postulate a missing text, Q, from which all four gospels were later derived. Everyone has a Q. Everyone wants it. Next in your Q, they say you think to yourself, why is this me? Not her. You hapless, not happening, not me. Mirror, warrior, mirage. Why not me? Mayhap, this not me. The exegesis. One, operation and irradiation are still the subject. Objective response, not predictable. Has not yet been very helpful. Obviously, then, the patient presenting with possible mammary cancer cannot wait. Management of an individual, desire to have everything done, even at the cost of undesirable complications. Two, did her doctor explain that cancer meant crab because it was supposed to look like a crab not moving sidewise? I have no oral history on paper from her, so I can neither confirm nor deny. Three, biographical repair of chicken gum, chewing wire, schmaltzy prosthetic prolepsis, whose repair? Four, we are going to use any means. Is that clear?
I love the Nixon imitation.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's I come by it honestly.
Yes. You can tell it's coming from deep inside. You're you're listening to Radio Free Albion, and that was Joe Harrington reading an excerpt from Things Come On, an amnoir, and closing that excerpt with a marvelous imitation of Richard Nixon. As you were reading that section, I kept going back to something you were talking about earlier when we were talking about research. This is a book of memories. But it's not just memory. I mean, there's this huge role that archives play in the book. And I love those moments, and there were some of them in what you read too, those moments where records of your mother's illness collide head on with records of the Nixon presidency. And like moments where you have lists of the real excruciating lists of what your mother's going through in the hospital at certain times, and then what Nixon is doing at certain times on the same day, or testimony on the same day. Those collisions are just really harrowing for readers, I think.
Yeah, they work for me too.
And that comes through too. I mean, it's interesting too, is that it's very clear. You're never once saying that I was 10 years old and the master of all my memories. You're very clear that my memories are vague, and not even all the archival records are available. And in fact, there's an 18 and a half minute gap in one of Nixon's cassettes, so there's a lot that's missing.
Yes, and when she was hospitalized for her surgery, it was a different hospital than where she died. And I wrote them for the records, or my dad did, because he's next of kin. And they wrote me a letter, which I reproduce in the book, saying that we've destroyed all records prior to 1980, and I've blacked out my dad's name and address and the name of the health information management manager at the hospital. So yeah, it does kind of, I mean, it is the same thing. I mean, it's about the lack of information, the erasure, the destruction of information. Because there's a lot of gaps. There's a lot of gaps in this book, and that's one of the reasons for the fragments.
It's one, and I think it's for a reader, it's part of the, it just, it gives the reader this little nudge to try to put themselves into the text too. And I found myself, 'cause you've got these gaps, and I feel like, I don't know, I feel like as a reader, I'm invited to jump into those gaps and see where I can be. And it was also kind of easy for me to do, 'cause I have these very strong memories myself of, as you at the very beginning of your book, watching the hearings with your mother, and then trying to impress her with your wry comments about what's, and I used to, I was 7 at the time, and I used to turn to my mother, and I could tell who were the enemies. And so I would say bad things about the enemy, because she hated Nixon, and so I thought, well, I want to hate Nixon too. And we really bonded. It was really emotional. And so when the story of your mother's cancer is twined then with the cancer on Nixon's presidency, it gets doubly emotional for me as a reader.
And I think a lot of people have a similar memory or similar experience. And for us, I think it was magnified by the fact that my family, my parents anyway, had been active in Democratic politics, had worked on Capitol Hill, had both worked for Senator Albert Gore Sr. And so, it was part of the family culture, if you will, to be, even at that young age, 10, 11, 12, I was beginning to be much more aware of politics than my peers were, probably at the same age.
And to have that be just part of daily discourse, that you knew these things.
I mean, I should say that this is part of a larger project I'm doing, a four-part project about my mother's life and times. And, I'm at work right now on the last part, which is about my childhood in Memphis. And I remember distinctly in 1968 on election night, and I'm watching the election returns on our black and white TV, and I say, "Hey, Mom, Dad, Humphrey's ahead." And they go, "Oh yeah, he is now." And it's just like this perfect moment of like this kind of child who like knows a little bit about politics, but still hasn't quite been exposed to it. And of course, that was pre-Watergate too, right?
Right. And I love that you know a little bit. You haven't been quite exposed to it, but you definitely want to participate. Like, look, Humphrey's ahead.
Yes, and want to be hopeful, you know? It's
Yeah,
like,
it's exactly. There's idealism there. Yeah.
right.
I'm thinking of another childhood narrative thread that's braided into the book really nicely is and it's very subtle. It's your love of baseball.
Oh, yeah.
And at one point you even say, like, it was,
Right.
correct me if I'm wrong, I think you say, like, Watergate and baseball helped me concentrate or something. Was
Yeah. Let me see. Oh, yeah. Here's one. Watergate helped me concentrate like baseball. Thank you, Henry Aaron. Thank you, Sam Dash. Sam Dash was he was the Democratic counsel on the Senate Select Committee on Watergate. And of course, I assume your listeners know who Henry Aaron was.
Well,
Brilliant.
if they don't know who Henry Aaron was, I'm going to say right now that one of the most fascinating parts, and I'll use the I think I've used this word harrowing, I'll use the word devastating now. One of the most devastating parts of the book for me is when you reproduce the letter from your mother,
Oh, yeah.
April 11th, 1974, and she's, like you said earlier, at that time, a cancer diagnosis, there really wasn't much hope. And she's talking about, well, here's what I want, here's how I want you to handle my funeral arrangements.
Yes.
And that's April 11th, 1974. That's 3 days after Henry Aaron broke Babe Ruth's record.
Yes.
And so, and you don't say that in the poem, but you've already sort of, as a reader, I've been signaled to think about Hank Aaron. And I'm like, there he is. And this is Hank Aaron, who, for people who follow baseball only a little bit, he's the guy who broke the home run record without being on steroids. So he's, for many of us, still the home run king.
Yes.
And it was shown on national TV, and you didn't get to see that many baseball games on national TV at the
Right.
time. And sorry, I keep going on.
It's
I
all right.
just wanted to weave
Awesome.
in Hank Aaron. When you reproduce that letter, it's an interesting choice. You're not writing about the letter. You're not just quoting from the letter. You physically reproduce it as an illustration.
And it was I think maybe in an original version I had just like reached I just typed it out or typed out much of it. And I think one of my friends who read it said, well, why don't you just reproduce the letter? And I realized, well, why not? I mean, I have it. It's legible. It says what it says much better than I could, and it says it much more, and it's the actual document in her actual handwriting. And the other, I mean, the one of the reasons that I put that in there, I'm trying to give an idea of what I take to be her character. I mean, this is all kind of a reconstruction project because she did die when I was 12, and so I didn't know her as well as people know their parents when they die at, 18 or when they're 65 or whatever. So it is kind of a reconstruction project, and one of the reasons that I wanted to put that in there was to give a sense of what of my image of her personality, which I think has a lot to do with being a Southern lady, quote unquote, the kind of gender socialization of women in the South in her era. And I think this is true of white women and African American women too, from my researches and experience, that there's a certain way in which you don't, as a friend of mine said, you don't talk about what hurts. You don't emote. You don't fall upon the thorns of life and bleed. There's a stoicism. And in a real way, women are the ones who keep it together, who keep the household together, who keep the society together. And I wanted to get that across. I think that letter really conveys that to me.
And I think, the choice to have it to bring in the illustration as opposed to just typing it out, I think it conveys it also. And it by then, by this point in the book, we're maybe halfway through the book when the letter appears. It's already clear your mother is already a three-dimensional person in the book, but I think that this just adds more to that, where if you had any illusions that she's, if as a reader you were just thinking, well, she's still just a persona and a narrative, I think the illustration You can't think that anymore after the illustration, because you're seeing her handwriting. You're seeing at the very bottom as she says, "I love you," and it's really tiny, but it's really like figuratively the biggest part of the letter. You know, there's no way that just giving us a typescript of that could convey the same thing, I think.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that's a big part of why I wanted to put that in there. Aura, there's a certain it's something that can't be reproduced without the document itself, I think.
Yeah, there's something, and I've talked to my students a lot about this when in teaching research and poetry classes, that there's just something about the actual archival document, to see the handwriting, to see the way that some, you know, how hard the person was pressing the pencil or the pen on the page, that you get, there's something emotional in that that's not just about clinically transcribing words.
It's interesting. There's a critic writer, University of Texas, named Ann Svetkovich, who has a term. I think she coined it, a feeling archive.
Yes.
And I really think that's a superb term, because it does bring together my interest in archive, in the notion of the archive, in the materiality of language, with the notion of affect, with the night, with feeling, because I think that a lot of times American poetry tends to try to emphasize one or the other, and it's very rare that you find the two in the same poem, which is kind of strange to say, but I think the way that the literary history of American poetry has been shaped in the post-war era, that's kind of how it's come about. The other thing I wanted to say about that letter too is that simply, I felt very bad, self-conscious about how little of my mother's voice was in the book. I have much more of her voice in the other parts of this project that I'm doing, but she's a patient for most of this book. So I pretty much used every bit of writing by her I could get, and put most of it in the book, because I wanted her to be one of the voices in the book.
I could see, as the writer and as the son, you know, thinking that. I mean, as a reader, I felt that, I think you're pretty aware as a reader, like, okay, she's going to have a limited voice because she's a patient, and sometimes her voice comes through in ways that are nonverbal, like when the nurses are attending to her and they're writing about her, but they're saying depressed today. You know, and I'm thinking, yeah, I'm sure depressed is the word, but I don't think depressed is also the quite the right word for cancer, someone who's suffering from cancer. We need like a super depression word that we don't have. You know, I really look forward to seeing the larger project, because I felt like her voice was coming through. I'd love to see then the entire 4-volume project, to see things come on as, something embedded in that larger tapestry, where we get maybe different vectors of her voice. Yeah.
Actually, parts of the next volume, part, whatever it is, it's called No Soap. There's been parts in The Collagist and Bathhouse, both of which are online, and Hotel America. So it's starting to get out there.
And it's called No Soap.
No Soap, which is a term that she uses in her high school diary a number of times, and I looked it up, and the most common meaning is like no dice, no go. Originally, I think it meant, back in the 19th century, it meant like, I'm sorry, I do not have money to lend you. But then by the 30s, it was just like, yeah, no way.
Can I borrow a quarter? No soap. Yeah.
Exactly.
So, and is the next volume close to being finished, or is it coming out soon? Should we be looking for it soon?
I'm waiting for someone to say that they'll publish it, actually. And there are some presses that are looking at it, I think, seriously.
That's great.
And then the next one, I've pretty much just finished and gotten to the point where I'm willing to show it without being too embarrassed, which is called Griefing on Summit, and that's the part where she's living in Washington, and spends most of the 50s being the Albert Gore senior's personal secretary, which is where she meets my dad because he works for him as well. And in that one, the idea of the archive really becomes super important. It kind of becomes a structuring device.
As you were talking about the next two volumes, it brought me back to something you said a few minutes ago about how contemporary, modern and contemporary poetry have sort of bounced back and forth between extreme focuses on an extreme focus on technique at the expense of emotion, and then sometimes an extreme focus on emotion at the expense of technique. And, you know, sometimes I feel that only part of a poem is getting heard because sometimes people only want to hear the technique or only want to hear the emotion. And I feel really good about the art form when I'm in reading another poet who wants both to be paramount in their work.
And it's really weird because I was afraid that this work would be too weird for kind of mainstream or, you know, post-confessional, or whatever you want to call it, readers, and that it would be too schmaltzy for experimental crowd. But actually what I found is that people who are interested in experimental writing became interested in it because of the form, and then found that were moved by it, and that people who are interested in the content, the story, became interested in the form and what it's doing and how and the role it's playing in producing whatever meaning there is. So I'm kind of pleased with that result.
It's nice to have a book where it can work against the grain of a reader, but it's not going to turn them off. It's actually going to turn them on more because it's working enough with them too.
Yeah.
Well, let's hear another poem.
Okay. Well, we've been talking about the book, Things Come On, so I'll just read another excerpt from that. This is later in the book than the first excerpt I read. It's about in the middle, really. And I should say one of the themes of the book is trying to produce order out of chaos. So using lists, charts, various means, textual means that we use just to try to produce order in life, not to mention at points in life that are difficult. So, 1974, Sun, Merc, Sat, through Mars, 11th and 12th house, light to dark, being cooped up, enclosing. It's almost like getting ready to die yourself. Pisces, February 19 through March 20. Continue imposing a form. In elegy, I is always the subject, but a narrative opens outward, thereby providing an order, even a list, even a pattern of stars. Find the two fishes swimming against each other in a circle. What is the story behind it? Answer by pasting the scraps. June 15, 1974. Rose Kushner discovers a small lump in her left breast. This I am not really definite on. The words I can remember from it are Joe's, stone crab, a summer sign, hers. You really do have to think long term, the same in this universe and a universe to come, in the myriad kalpas of gigabytes of worlds, and later I have to go pick up some milk. It's just that I don't especially like all those creatures in the Cambrian shale. And I don't appreciate the idea of cutesy sea otters and cerulean warblers dropping dead to make way for microorganisms and bivalves and people like me. The something there is that doesn't love a life loves life. What was your face before you were born? It's right there in the fossil record. Endless sickening iterations of nightmares led to me. Where is the black milk? We led too. In this change and the earth to come, the Republic will endure. And if I go through with this, I won't end up like her. That is the promise of the incantation. Harrington, Elizabeth P., age 58, 3593 Genesee Street. Harrington, Elizabeth P., age 53, 3993 Genesee Street. Harrington, Elizabeth P., age 58, 3593 Tennessee Street. Harrington, Elizabeth P., age 52, 3393 Genesee Street. Harrington, Elizabeth P., age 52, 3593 Tennessee Street. portable chest shows the heart within normal limits. Flame before glass reflects flames inside rib cage. Heart immolate, broken hearth rages. Find your voice. Poof, combustion, flicklet, smoke. Why do you think they call us ghosts? Who's to say the mouse isn't? In pulses, intervals.
That was Joe Harrington reading from Things Come On. I've been talking with Joe today on Radio Free Albion about Things Come On, which is his most recent book. It's available, it was published by Wesleyan in 2011, and it's available everywhere you want to buy books online, including independent sites like Small Press Distribution, spdbooks.org, and it's available at bookstores that carry books of poetry from independent presses. To get to know Joe and his work some more, go to his blog, Blog of Myself, at josephharrington.blogspot.com. That's Joseph Harrington, one word, .blogspot.com. Thanks for coming on the show, Joe. It's been great talking with you.
Thank you so much for having me, Tony.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Albion. If you're a poet and you'd like to be on a future show, or if you just want to email me and tell me what you thought of today's show, you can get in touch with me at Radio Free Albion, that's one word, radiofreealbion@gmail.com. You can also go to the show's Twitter page, twitter.com/radiofreealbion. Thanks again for listening.